hosted by Paul from Cliff Richard Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Wired for Sound podcast with Paul. On this week's podcast, I talk to singer-songwriter Chris Eaton. Chris talks about his songs he's written with Sir Cliff, everything from Where Do We Go From Here up to Falling For You. It's a great interview with a fantastic person. Enjoy. Honored to talk to you. You've written some absolutely fantastic songs for Sir Cliff. How did it come about?
Well, I met Sir Cliff actually when I was very, very young, and I think I was probably in my mid-teens. Mm-hmm. And Cliff was doing Tear Fund concerts, actually big gospel concerts throughout the country. Yep. And he had a support act called Dave Pope and the Alethians. And Dave happened to be someone that I knew through my church connections. Yep. Growing up, and I did a lot of playing for Dave. So it was really Dave who introduced me to Cliff. That was initially when I wasn't even kind of doing a concert. But then a couple of years later, I was actually playing for Dave Pope at this big festival up in Yorkshire. And Cliff was there as well. And he didn't have a band. So he came to us and he said, "Do you guys, will you be up for playing for me?" And we were like, I think so. Didn't have to think about that one for too long.
Yeah.
So it was amazing. Yeah, we just played a song for him, and then that was really my first sort of introduction to getting to know him personally. And and I'd written a few songs that Dave was singing, and one of them was called Sail Away, which I wrote and sang myself that night.
Yeah.
And Cliff just was very taken with it and came to me and he said, "Oh, I love that song, Sail Away. Have you got any more like that?" And I said, "I've got about 200, actually, Cliff." And he said, "Well, if you could send me a tape of maybe five of your best songs, I would really love to hear them." And, of course, I waltzed away all excited as a 19-year-old, thinking, yeah, "Oh, my gosh, this is written in the stars. You know, it's kind of meant to be." Yeah. And interestingly enough, the week after, I was on a tour at the time, and the week after, it was incredible how things fell into place. I actually met a guy over having an Indian curry after a gig, who owned a 24-track studio.
Oh, wow.
Now, I had no way of recording these songs. And he just said, "Look, I love these songs, Chris, and I'm really happy to help. Why don't you come down to my studio? I'll get the band together. I'll do it for free, and you can cut, like, five songs." It was unbelievable. So, you know, I had this selection of my favorite songs. I had them really nicely recorded. And of course, a lot of hope and expectation when I sent the tape. Little did I know that I was going to get a letter from Cliff's secretary saying, "Don't call us, we'll call you." And that was it. And so for a long period of time, you know, even though I thought Cliff would respond favorably, it was kind of getting to the point where I thought he'd forgotten about it, because I carried on doing semi-pro music and working as a driver for a beer truck and different, you know, working in a fruit shop. And eventually it was incredible, because I just had a sense from a spiritual point of view that I should give it up, you know, just kind of lay it down and let God, who was, you know, if you like, in charge of my life. I was like very committed Christian at the time. And I thought, I'm getting really frustrated with God here, and frustrated that this, what seemed like was going to happen, hasn't. And so, you know, I remember just praying a prayer. Actually, I've been to my local church, and I felt one of those times when you hear a word that you feel is just for you. And it was just incredible, and it just made me stop me in my tracks and really made me realize that actually the God that I believed in wanted the best for me, had made me and had a plan for me, and I had just got to basically let it go and let him deal with it. So I had a real sense of peace at that night, having sort of prayed that prayer. And then literally, this was 18 months after I'd sent the tape to Cliff. And then I just got a phone call 3 days later saying, Cliff's secretary here, Jill Snow, do you remember the tape you sent? And I said, yeah, of course. And she said, well, Cliff's going to record four of the five songs.
Nice.
Unbelievable. And, you know, Paul, it was very exciting, but at the same time, it was kind of humbling because it made me realize that I had to get my priorities right.
Yeah.
And it taught me a big lesson early in my career to not hold on to things too tightly. And if they're meant to be, they'll come back at you. And so, that was it. And two of those songs went on Wired for Sound, Lost in a Lonely World and Summer Rain. And they were the first two, you know, hits that I had and the first two big songs. So, and then I signed a deal, a publishing deal to write exclusively for Cliff for 3 years and to his publishing company. So from then on, even though I was still writing a lot of songs for myself and for other artists, I prioritized writing for Cliff. And so it was amazing because I just, you know, got quite a lot of songs, fortunately, on his next few albums as a result of that.
No, you're behind just amazing songs. And I think even today, whenever Cliff releases something new and we know there's going to be a Chris Eaton song on it, we know it's going to be an amazing song. I mean, even in the last album, Falling For You, that is such a catchy song.
Well, thank you. It's interesting that, you know, I guess one of the things that's really struck me has been the longevity of my friendship with Cliff. And, you know, we know each other well. And I guess there's something in my spirit that is close to what he listens to and what moves him. And melodically, I tend to sort of pitch my voice on the demos in a way that I think Cliff would understand them and think, yeah, I can sing this, you know.
Yeah.
And that song, actually, Falling For You, I wrote on holiday, when I was on holiday on a beach chair, and I was sat there with my wife having a glass of wine, and I just got my headphones on and I started like writing the song in my head. So I wrote sort of half the lyric and then I wrote the music in my head, and I thought, I've just got this feel for how it's going to go. You know, I really was keen to reintroduce the Alan Tiney feel to Cliff, because that to me is like the best period of his pop life.
Yeah, it certainly is.
You know, we don't talk anymore, and some people, you know, always guaranteed the album. I mean, all of that, I'm No Hero, you know, it was just one massive song after another, and it was just fantastic. So, I wrote that song, and then I got back home, and I hadn't finished the lyric, and I was due to write with a really great writer, a great friend of mine, AJ Brown, and he was at my house the day after I got home from my holidays, and I said, look, I've written this song, and it's not quite finished yet. Do you want to finish it with me? And he's like, yeah, let's do it. So, Falling For You was born. And actually, you know, I sent that to Cliff, not at the time that I wrote it, because I think we were on holiday in October, and he had just got a brand new album out at that time with two or three of my songs on it.
Yeah.
Rise Up was the first single. And then I had, Reborn,
fantastic.
Which was the next single, and then there were a couple of other tracks that I had on the album as well. And so I didn't send the Falling For You to Cliff at that time because he's had too much of me. I'm like, you know, this is overkill, Chris. He's gonna be no, Chris. Not gonna happen. So I just thought, let's be a bit strategic with this because I love the song.
Yeah.
So I left it until the spring, until everything had kind of calmed down a bit with his album project. And then I just sent this to him. I said, look, Cliff, I really love this song. I think you could do it great. And he was like, wow, I love it. And he got it earmarked, I think, initially as a duet, but he ended up doing it solo. So, I mean, honestly, Paul, I mean, that's the last one I've had with him. But, you know, we've got such a good working relationship. And, you know, I was involved with his Nashville albums and, you know, it's just been brilliant, really. Yeah. So as long as he's still touring and still willing to sing a tune, yeah, then I'll write him one.
Because sure. You're also behind Reborn was such an anthem for Cliff coming out of what he did, but also during it, Golden, even though it was recorded in 2008, I think, for his 50th anniversary, it's just a song, I think, now that just captures the hearts of all the fans.
Yeah.
Leaves many in tears.
Well, I mean, I guess I didn't really realize that when it was written, that was going to be the case. But because it was actually written before he went through all the court case and, you know, all the stuff that he had to go through. But, you know, it really was applicable incredibly. It was meant to be, I think, and you know, Rise Up was his first single, and that was, you know, I'm kind of like, I'm going to stand up and be me myself, but I think Reborn had a more celebratory. I think Rise Up had anger in it.
It did, yeah,
more angry,
yeah,
and I think Reborn was after that, and it was like, okay, I'm here, I'm celebrating. You know, because Reborn, you know, whether you're spiritual or not, whether it's a spiritual being reborn or or whether, I mean, for us right now, I mean, you know, such an incredibly poignant song, because we've got, you know, we've all been through, you guys, I suppose, you know, I've been looking and it looks like New Zealand have probably had the lightest effect on most of the countries, thankfully.
Yeah, thank
you. But, you know, we've, as you know, have had it pretty rough and, you know, it's just been absolute hell. I mean, it really has. And, you know, we're very grateful to, you know, live in a nice part of the world, and we've got country walks that we can do. And, you know, but I mean, honestly, the industry is basically closed down, and it's been really hard, just mentally, anxiety wise. And then you start to feel, even this week, you know, my son on the 29th, which was Monday, was able to play football outside for the first time in like 4.5 months. It's crazy. You know? I had my first game of golf on Monday, and I was like, birdie the first. I was a happy chap. Nice. And it was just, and you start to begin, I'm starting to feel that kind of feeling of being reborn again. Like, well, wait a minute, you know, I've got a life to live. I've got something to give.
Yeah.
So let's just take it one step at a time, but you know, enjoy friends as and when we can, and open it all up. And I think, Paul, through all of this, it's made us all realize how vital music is to us.
Yeah, certainly has. Yeah.
You know, it's incredible, isn't it? And, you know, just to hold on to the songs that you love and to be able to play them and feel that, you know, a real sense of understanding from them. You know, that can be your best friend. A song can really be your best friend when you don't really, we're not seeing anybody.
Yeah, and, definitely.
So that's good, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing about, and also in particular, your songs and Cliff singing them, they can be interpreted by the listener to anything, really, if it's a love between a person or a love with God. I think a song that really got to me was when I was going through a really hard time a number of years ago, was All the Time You Need. It's a song that I just ended up turning up loud and playing over and over and over again.
Well, I mean, All the Time You Need, the story behind that was, I have to say right now, I'm standing in a very sort of blessed place, because I have a lovely wife who I'm very happy with, and we've been together now for 12 years or something. I've got a little 8-year-old boy, and, you know, there's healing in this, in my life, which is very tangible, and Abby is just amazing. I can't imagine, you know, my life without her and without Beau, my son. But when I look back, it seems a long time ago now, but I was married, and after 2 or 3 years, it went a bit pear-shaped, and I was very, very broken with it. A lot of things, you know, feelings I had to deal with. And so All the Time You Need actually was originally called Remember Me. It was, you know, it was just very honestly written at a time when we were splitting up, And so it was very real. It was very, very real. It was, and I couldn't sing it live for ages because it was too close to what I'd been through. And I did eventually record a version myself that Alan Tarmy produced because he loved it so much, called Remember Me.
Oh, nice.
But then Cliff heard it and wanted to record it.
Yeah.
And he'd already had Remember Me as a song.
Yeah.
Remember Me, you know. And so he's like, All the Time You Need is a great title, you know, let's do it. So it was, and I think in some ways it was a very, I mean, Cliff might, you'd have to ask him this, but I feel like it was one of the first songs that had that amount of depth in it.
Yeah.
Like that amount of truth in it that Cliff sang really from the heart. It was almost quite painful for him because he kind of dove into that part, even though he maybe hadn't gone through that heartache himself, he could sense it in the song. And I think he delivered it. And, you know, a far cry really from the, you know, got myself for crying, walking, you know. You know, and I think sometimes I'm probably guilty of writing songs that hurt, you know, that perhaps a bit too deep and a bit too honest, but that's just the way I write. And, you know, I was really quite surprised that Cliff did that, but again, very grateful because people like yourself could relate, you know, so it was wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. And of course, can't not mention Cliff without Christmas. And Little Town and Santa's List and the big one, Saviour's Day, which still enters the charts at Christmas, even today. How did Saviour's Day come about?
I think by the time that I wrote Saviour's Day, I was very kind of aware of having had Little Town as my first sort of hit, if you like, my first single hit back in 1982. And I was aware that Cliff had a couple of years of big songs at Christmas. Mistletoe Wine obviously would have been huge.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of motivated a year before it was released to write something that had a feel of how I could imagine Cliff doing it. It needed that big sway kind of feel, you know, it needed a 6/8, you know, but it had a Celtic, sort of Celtic musical feel to it, which I really loved. And one of my favorite Christmas song probably ever is I Believe in Father Christmas by Greg Lake, which was a massive, massive hit. But just that whole, you know, using the classical melodies was just such a turn on for me. So, and I just love that kind of atmosphere and that almost cinematic feel of Saviour's Day. So when I wrote that, I actually wrote it, I was motivated to write it because there was a guy who he's a very well-known speaker and minister whose name's Steve Chalk. Mm-hmm. And Steve is a big media character these days, did a lot of stuff for radio, but he was in charge of a charity called Oasis Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve, I knew Steve, and he asked me if I could write something that would be sung alongside that. They had a sort of initiative called Christmas Unwrapped, i.e. unwrapping the true meaning of Christmas. And so that was all the motivation I needed. You know, he just said, you know, if you could come up with something, that would be great. Well, Saviour's Day was born, you know, and when I was writing it, I just had all these sort of things about what's important in the Christmas song. You know, it's coming home, being with your loved ones, your family. And in my case, I was spending a lot of time on the road, on tour.
Oh, yes.
So it meant a lot to me to spend time with my family.
Yeah.
So that was one of the reasons why that lyric was in there. The whole thing of like laying down barriers between each other and you know, people of different creed and color and race and religion getting together was a huge thing for me. And then just you know, the celebration of the fact that the Clifford had other Christmas songs and there were massive Christmas hits around didn't necessarily point the way to the real meaning of Christmas. And I thought this is an opportunity for me as a Christian, to, you know, I didn't really feel comfortable writing a Christmas song that didn't have Jesus at the heart of it.
Yeah.
For me, it was like when I actually thought of that moment, if you like, the light bulb moment when this is called, it's got to be called Saviour's Day. And Christmas Day is Saviour's Day. And also every day is our Saviour's Day. No matter who we are, you know, we get the opportunity to meet face to face with God and make our own choice, then that could be our Saviour's Day. And that's, you know, that whole thing got me all excited about the potential power, I guess, of the song. So I was thrilled, obviously thrilled that it got to number one. I was thrilled that that Cliff did it. First time I played it to him was a year before he did it at a Christmas party. And it was in the afternoon at his publishing company party. And I always used to go down there armed with a song. This time I'd come armed with this little baby of mine called Saviour's Day. And I saw Cliff and he said, "Have you got anything to play me?" And I said, "Yeah, I've got something I'm really excited about." He goes, "Come on then, your car or mine?" And then he goes, "Oh, mine. Mine's a Rolls and it's got a much better stereo." So we left the party. We went and sat down in the car, and literally it was a cassette tape and I played it, and he stopped it after about a minute and took a look at me and just said, "This is a number one song and I'm going to record it."
Yeah.
And it was like goosebumps in that moment. And that was literally the Christmas of the year before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, true to his word. And I have to say, Cliff has always been very loyal. He knows, obviously, he's spotting great songs and he's very specific about what he likes to record. But then once he's decided he's going to do it, he doesn't let anybody put him off. You know, he's like, "No, I'm going to do this." And so, of course, we recorded the video in the summer at a place called Durdle Door, which was hilarious. So I had to try and make that look like it was minus 10 when it was about 20 degrees. But when the video was made, then I kind of knew that the single would be released.
Yeah.
That there was too much, you know, commitment that had gone into the video. Mm. And then, of course, it was wonderful because it was his biggest new entry ever.
Yeah.
Straight in at number six. And then he went 6, 3, 2, 1. And just beat Madonna and Vanilla Ice to number one. So big celebrations, amazing.
And also the follow-up in 2003, Santa's List, still has a lot of deep meaning. What's going on in the world, even today. You know, the only wish on Santa's List is peace on earth.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a song that I wrote in Nashville. Actually, which is kind of my second home, and I go there 3 or 4 times a year to write. There's some amazing musicians and writers in Nashville, and you know, I just love it there. And, I wrote with a guy, Nick Trevisic, who's an English guy who lives in Nashville, and he's a rock and roller. Actually, he produces a lot of rock music, and he's got that real edge, you know. And we got together. We'd written a few things before for other artists, and he's like, "Let's write a Cliff song." I think we just discussed what we would say in it. And actually my demo, I liked what Cliff did with it actually, but the demo was quite more aggressive. It was a bit more, I didn't think Cliff would do it because we did it more kind of, dun, 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 "Merry Christmas, we don't need," it's almost like a, "We don't need a Merry Christmas." You know, the whole point was it's more of a sort of a youth statement, you know, that you could hear a band doing. Yeah. And but Cliff did it in a sort of slightly more sophisticated, you know, posher way. and it worked, you know, it still worked. I mean, it was funny that it got a lot of airplay and went straight into chart number 6 or something and then went straight out. It was hilarious. So it didn't quite peak at the right point.
Yeah.
But I love singing that. I mean, Abby, my wife, and myself, we do that every Christmas.
Yeah.
And we just love it. I absolutely love it live. It's great. I just bang it away on the piano, you know.
Yeah.
Feels great. I feel like Jules Holland on 10.
And speaking of Nashville, I mean, an album also that I feel is underrated is Something's Going On album. And again, Full Life and Faithful One, I Don't Want to Lose You, They're just songs that just really speak volumes to the listener.
Wow, thank you. I mean, that was a lot of fun because it was Cliff's idea, and he wanted to incorporate some of the best writers in Nashville. Mm-hmm. So it was a really interesting experiment because a lot of writers were asked to come along, and they were all excited to write for Cliff. But of course, Cliff isn't as so big in Nashville or in America as he is in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
But once they realized he'd sold 250 million records to that point, they were definitely interested in getting a cut.
Yeah.
So we literally sat around this boardroom and we kind of drew lots as to who would write with who. Mm-hmm. And we were there for like a week. So we wrote every day for a week with different writers. Yeah. And we went off in different rooms and just threw ourselves into it. And, you know, Cliff would come in and go, well, I love these songs, you know, keep going, keep going. And then he'd say, right, I want a song about a car.
Yep.
In the end, what car was the song that he chose?
Yeah.
but we were all busy writing car songs. It was hilarious, you know. And we're all going, oh, because he was like the Black Camaro or something. That I think that's in that car. Yeah. And it was just funny. So, you know, we're all writing the car, a great car song. I loved For Life. I guess Unchained Melody was an influence in that song a little bit.
Yeah.
Just the simplicity. And Cliff actually did it so nice. And it doesn't need much, that song. That's sometimes you need a big production to sell a song.
Yeah.
And then other times it's just about the true meaning, and it's simple, and that's the song. Those are songs I really love. You know, my favorite song of all time, I would say, is "Bridge Over Troubled Water" Simon and Garfunkel. And what an awesome song, and the way it moves you, and it's just beautifully written. I mean, there's some great ones out there, but you play that on the piano and it works. Mm. And that's the thing for life. You know, it's just simple. Got on great with the guy that I wrote it with. I remember it really well. And we just knew that we had something that had happened that day. And then Faithful One, I'm not sure that we wrote specifically for Cliff for that project.
Mm-hmm.
It was written, I co-wrote it with a guy called Brian White, who I wrote a lot with in Nashville. He's an awesome writer.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian's a great lyric writer, and we he's a Christian, and we both just dug deep on that one. And to be honest, of all the songs that I've written for Cliff,
mm-hmm.
I think Faithful One, I almost feel like hasn't had its day.
Yeah.
The way it could have.
Yeah.
It's because it's a hymn. It's a modern hymn, really. And Michael O'Martin produced it,
mm-hmm.
who produced like Christopher Cross and, you know, some amazing artists. And he did that string intro. Mm-hmm. Absolutely stunning, you know. And I was so moved by that, and I just thought, this, what a collaboration, you know. Does that just set the scene for the song? And the demo for Faithful One was sung by a brilliant artist called Susan Ashton, who was in the contemporary Christian music scene. She also, she was a big artist for on Columbia for in the country music scene as well. And she went on tour with Garth Brooks and various other people. And she has the most amazing voice. She's one of these people that never, ever sings out of tune. It's impossible. She doesn't know how.
Yeah.
But she got the heart right. And, you know, she just delivered that song so beautifully. And I was thrilled that Cliff did it. And, of course, Cliff actually sang that song at Cilla Black's funeral, which was totally unexpected. I had no idea. We were all very upset about Cilla's death. And I remember going, I think I was going to London for a concert with my wife, actually, and we were in the car and we were listening to the funeral, because it, or to the service, to the memorial service.
Yeah.
And we knew that Cliff there, but I had no idea. And then the next thing he goes, I'm going to sing this song a friend of mine wrote, you know, and he sings Faithful One. And I'm like filling up. I'm thinking, this is, maybe this song's written just for this moment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It was just such a heartbreaking moment. And I think that song really, really fitted what Cliff was going through with losing Scylla. Yeah. And I think you did also mention after that, that Faithful One was one of Scylla's favorite songs.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, again, you know, Paul, I'm so often reminded of what an honour it is to do what I do, because I just feel it connects me with people who are listening to the songs in a way that I don't, you know, we don't know each other, but there's a connection there straight away because we just feel like you're on the same page. And, you know, I think I've always felt it's part of my call in life. It's part of my mission, really.
Yeah.
To write honest songs that allow us as a race to be closer and to be more in love with each other and to get into, you know, just, I don't know, do our best to put aside all the crap that's happening and, you know, just be real and just be gracious, you know, with each other. And I have to say, in terms of grace, you know, there's no one more gracious on the planet than Sir Cliff. You know, he is so genuine.
Yeah,
he's amazing. He's, you know, people were like, "Well, what's he really like?" You know,
yeah.
And I'd love to say, "Well, oh, you know, he's really mean," and you know, but he's not. You know, he's just a very gentle, kind man who's, you know, thankfully in love with his own music.
Yeah,
I mean, he's completely. It's not a career for him. You know, it's a way of life, and. You know, I think he's been criticized in the past for perhaps not having a relationship.
Yep.
And to me, it's like, well, you can see when you know him, you can see that he just has great people around him. He's got, you know, good friendship base and his family. But at the end of the day, it wasn't meant that he should have that kind of relationship because he's married to his music.
Yep.
And, you know, to the point where, and I'm very grateful for that because every new album he does, you know, he will certainly listen to whatever I send, and you know, I'm very grateful. I mean, I've got my idols, you know, of people that I have met or have worked with who've written what I consider the best songs for Cliff.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, there are three or four writers that you know you could mention that are icons, you know, that I sort of was very young growing up with. You know, I mean, Bruce, of course, and Alan Tarney. I mean, I loved Alan. I love Alan still. I mean, I just think he's a genius. And when you listen now to the production and the vocal quality of Cliff's vocals when he was at his, you know, prime, which was really, I mean, he can still hold a tune, but it's obviously he's in his 80s and it's a different world now.
Yeah, yeah.
To be able to, you know, really sort of zing, if you like, get that zing happening. And but when you listen to like Some People, well, that's one of the best vocals he's ever done. Yeah. And that whole era, you know, the early 80s, I guess, early to mid 80s, was just magnificent.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love him to sing Discovering Again because that song is very powerful and it would be good to hear him sing it today.
Yeah. I think he would actually. If he does go back on the road, hopefully, and we all start, you know, paying our money and going to see him again, I think he certainly is more, he's always up for singing old songs, bringing them out of the closet, you know, I think, and putting them in his set. He does do that from time to time. And I remember a song I wrote called Joanna, which wasn't a big hit for him, but I loved it. And he did that quite a bit live because it was one of his favorites. And, you know, it's just, I want to, but thank you for discovering. I mean, that was probably one of the earliest songs I ever wrote. I was probably about 18 or something when I wrote Discovering. Yep. So that had to wait a while to get cut. And then I toured with Cliff actually at one point and played keyboards and sang with him. Yeah. And I remember doing this. This is a funny story, but the band were always up to tricks. And,
yeah,
you know, you never know. You will never know. As an audience who come and see Cliff, we all look, everybody's just like doing their job and looks so professional, and it's note for note perfect, you know.
Yeah.
And so that sometimes the band gets a little bit too big for its boots, or basically just wants to sort of have a bit of fun behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And basically one little test for me was that I got earphones, I got my monitors, so I was listening to Cliff singing Discovering, and I was playing the keyboard part. And at the same time, in my other ear, I got the MD, who's the other keyboard player, who wasn't playing on the song, shouting obscenities in my ear whilst I'm trying to play the song for 10,000 people. And, my gosh, it was terrible. And I, it was like everything I could possibly do to just, you know, completely close one ear and just get on with it. But I think I just about managed it. But it was, yeah, that kind of thing quite a bit.
Yeah. And then he said, when I spoke to him last in October for Cliff Richard Radio, songs that he was going to bring back for the 80th tour, unfortunately didn't go ahead, but one of them was Where Do We Go From Here. He wanted to sing that again.
Well, yeah, I mean, I loved Where Do We Go. I mean, again, that was one of the first ones. That was on the original five-song tape.
Oh, yes.
And and that went on the the album after Wired for Sound. I think it went on there, saying Now You See Me, Now You Don't. And that was, yeah, released as a single with, I can't remember, there was another one on there. It was Now You See Me was a single, and there was another one as well. But it was, and then Discovering was on that album as well. Where Do We Go? Just pop, just total, yeah, straight down the line. I guess, you know, in the early days particularly, the reason why Cliff took a chance on me, which I look back and I'm very grateful for, and it was certainly meant to be.
Yeah.
He recognized in the songs, you've already said it, the songs that could be interpreted as a love song or a song to God, were never written. I never had a problem. We didn't have Christian music in growing up in my family, or particularly, and we went to church, but there was no CCM scene as such. So I didn't really listen to Christian music in the early days. I was just pop. I was just into pop. And Hall & Oates and Steely Dan and Yes and all these different bands I was like totally into, and their influences were in my music. But so I loved great melody and great pop, but I didn't have a problem once I had made a step of faith in my own life, and I realized that actually God for me was who he said he was, and that, possible for this relationship to happen. I realized that I didn't have a problem singing a song that was, I felt was God's heart. So if I said to you, you don't think you know me, but I know you better than you know yourself, you know. Yeah. I love you more than you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
I know that God is saying that to me right now. You know, I just sense that God is our maker. And so I don't have a problem saying I, whereas a lot of Christians couldn't write a song like that. They think, well, when you're putting yourself in the place of God, you know, you're like, you've got to make it third party. You know, he loves you.
Yeah.
But I just thought, well, why? You know, if you know that you can be the voice, if you like, that speaks the truth that God has in his heart, and it's just that much more poignant, it's that much more powerful when it's in the direct person.
Yeah.
And so Cliff heard it and he just thought, you know, this is a love song. These are love songs, absolutely love songs, but I know that they have this spiritual dimension to them. Yeah. So, you know, I guess I was the first person that he took a risk on in terms of being someone who had a faith but was still writing pop songs. So he was happy to put my songs on his pop albums.
Yeah.
Because until that point, he'd always done gospel albums and then just used gospel music for those albums. And, you know, there are one or two other people as well. Paul Field comes to mind, obviously, who wrote Millennium Prayer.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is amazing. And Paul's written some great stuff for Cliff. And, but yeah, just amazing blessing, really.
Well, thank you very much for talking to you. It's been absolute privilege listening to all these stories, and thank you for all these amazing songs that you've
written. It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks, Paul, for inviting me on the program, and you know, just for all those Cliff fans out there, you know, hang in there. He'll be back, and you know, we're a family, aren't we?
Yeah.
And I think when you see the way Cliff is, whenever he's on the social media now and whatever he does on the media, you know, he's very grateful for you guys. He's very grateful for the people who are putting themselves out to promote his music and to keep, you know, flying the flag. So well done, Paul. Keep going.
Thank you so much.
See you.
Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure.
Have a good night. Thank you.
Pleasure, mate. Speak to you soon.
Thanks. Take care. Bye.
Hey, you too.
Hosted by Paul from Cliff Richard Radio.